Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. One of the main reasons I love radio is because of imagery. Yep, you heard right, imagery. Unlike a book or article, a radio story doesn't have the luxury of showing you pictures to accompany the words. So, as a radio producer, you have to rely on creating an image in a listener's mind with audio alone. And for me, the radio stories that sweep me away the most are those that bring me into new worlds with scene after scene of sound. The podcast Radiotonic is a haven of audio auteurs who are obsessed with creating lush, sonic palettes that not only serve as background to a narrative, but become active vehicles for the story. Produced by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, Radiotonic is an hour-long mix of fiction, nonfiction, essays, and drama from writers, artists, and radio makers. If you like The Spot or other shows that cherry-pick and present groups of different stories, Radiotonic is a show for you. Recently, they produced a story taking us to a part of the world which is known for its solitude and silence. My advice as you listen? Relax. Let the sounds wash over you, and let the images build in your mind. I'll let Jennifer Kingsley lead the way from here.
This is the story of how I visited two places at once and met a brother along the way.
Oh my God, there it goes!
Wow!
You don't get closer than that.
You'll never guess where I am. First off, I'm on a boat in a lounge, surrounded by sleek and comfy chairs, picture windows, and a bar. This song floats from the speakers in the ceiling. Second, I'm smack in the middle of the Canadian Arctic. Icebergs float by. Seabirds glide over the surface of the ocean. Ice breaks. It's summer in the north, and it's supper time. I check out the rush in the kitchen where plate after plate is artfully prepared, and I head out into the dining room. I sit down to enjoy dinner with some of the guests on board. It's warm inside. Dinner's delicious. It's always delicious. And I can keep an eye on the ice through the window. It's another day at work for me, but let me back up. I work in the Arctic as a naturalist and guide on this ship. I spend time with the guests who are paying for this trip, and I help them learn about the ecosystems we visit. The ship I'm on takes 140 passengers, and it's really nice. We have comfy beds, fresh baked bread, an espresso machine. We even have a baby grand piano. There are windows and decks everywhere, so we can watch the world go by. We leave the ship regularly, too. We cruise around in little boats, we hike, we stop and we meet people. Everyone feels the pull of the Arctic, though almost nobody is from the north. With one exception, Kisa. He's a guide, too, and he's Inuit. He's an expert hunter. The tundra is home for him. I became a guide on this boat after paddling across the Arctic twice in a canoe. Out in a little boat, the landscape looks much the same, but with fewer people. And it sounds completely different. The tundra all around our ship sounds like this. At least as close as I could get to it with a handheld recorder and a few spare minutes. But when I'm on board, I can't hear it in the same way. The ship is its own small world, floating through a much larger one. On the ship, there's always something in the way of that quiet. On the top deck, which has the most amazing view, it's the radar. On the bridge, we're hushed, but also behind glass. Watching wildlife on board is communal and exciting.
This is as close as it gets. Not kidding. Look at the body. Look at the markings on the body.
And it can get loud.
Single blowhole. This is as good as it gets, you guys. I'm not kidding. Oh my God, there it goes. That was awesome.
Even the sound of the ice is the sound of us, of our ship, crashing into it. We're constantly colliding with the landscape around us. When I spent weeks in a canoe crossing the tundra, I never thought about it. I'd take whatever the day had to offer. Wind, cold, rain, bugs. Some days I longed for one of the luxuries I've gotten used to on this ship, like a piece of fruit or clean sheets. Before getting on this ship, I didn't think much about what I would miss when the tables were turned. I need some kind of link to keep me out there. I lie on my comfy bed at night and wonder what's happening outside. I love how this ship can explore, how safe it is, but I miss the continuity of a completely outdoor experience where you never get a break. I miss relying on all of my senses.
We saw two at the start, right?
Two at the start?
This is Kisa, the Inuit guide and hunter I told you about.
Three over there, that's five. Five.
He's from a small island in the territory of Nunavut.
And we saw three, seven, eight, nine. One bull, ten. Ten. One, two.
And we're sitting together. Three, we're trying to remember the number of caribou we saw that day.
Nine, ten, 11.
Yeah, 11.
Yeah.
That's good.
11, tuk-tu.
Tuk-tu means caribou in his language, Inuktitut.
I thought it was 13.
Kisa has a lot of skills, and he's the best by far at spotting polar bears. When we're on the ship, we want to see polar bears. They are amazing to watch. But when we're on land, they pose a threat. They're hunters, and they're hungry. All of us guides carry rifles, just in case. It might sound strange, but it's standard to be armed up here.
Jason, Beebe, can you please come ashore and bring your gun? There is a polar bear about a mile away, so the groups need to stay tight.
Kisa is pointing to a polar bear that he sees ashore here. Kisa always finds the bears first. I think I see it too here. Nope, I don't see it. Kisa doesn't like my microphone, but we spend more and more time together. Others feel uncomfortable with him, I think, because he doesn't talk much. But that's exactly what draws me to him. When we're out on the land, he takes off on his own to scout for bears and look around. I think he needs a little peace and quiet. Kisa and I start hanging out, which means we sit beside each other sometimes. I ask him questions, we drink tea, I work on my Inuktitut, Nanuk, polar bear, Omingmuk, muskox. And one day, a couple of weeks into our journey, Kisa starts the conversation, which is unusual. He tells me that he would like to call me his sister, and I can call him brother. He teaches me how to say this, Anikuluk, my brother. Maybe he says this to all the girls, but I'm touched. When we meet some hunters outside a small community, Kisa calls down from our big boat to their tiny one.
You know what I mean? No. I told him you're my sister.
Now, when we stop in villages and he meets friends, he introduces me in this way, as his sister. Most people smile or laugh. I'm 6 feet tall and white. Kisa is much shorter, 20 years older, and Inuk. But I'm happy to do as he asks. Ulakut anikuluk. Good morning, my brother. Later on, we're traveling through heavy sea ice. I am feeling peopled out. I find Kisa in the lounge by the window. I sit beside him. I ask, do you find everyone on this boat really loud? Yes, he says. Does it bother you? No. Did it bother you when you first started working here? No. Then we both look out the window. With my face against the glass, looking at so much ice, I can really see where we are. Having Kisa there seems to expand the silence, so I can almost hear it too. The longer we sit, the quieter it gets. We see an endless field of broken ice outside that window. It's white, with turquoise pools of water scattered everywhere. As we pass, our ship knocks against the ice. Pieces flip over, and water gushes over top of them. Very often, the water carries little fish with it. They flail around in the evening air. Gulls do their best to pick them up and eat them. The gulls are the hunters, and Kisa's on their team. Finally. There, he got one, Kisa says. You see, he got one. We sit and watch for a long time. Kisa holds the silence for both of us. There's no hurry. The sun takes hours to set.
That story was recorded and produced by Jennifer Kingsley, along with RN's Creative Audio Unit from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. It originally aired on the podcast Radiotonic, which releases a new episode every week through their podcast feed. You can find Radiotonic on iTunes. You're listening to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. While listening to that last story, did you get the sense that you were actually transported directly into Jennifer's Arctic world? Do you maybe want to go somewhere warmer? On our next Sonic Adventure, we are heading to Hawaii. Scott Carrier has been a regular contributor to This American Life since the show's beginning. He's also an author, Peabody Award-winning radio producer, and educator. Several years ago, inspired by music, he decided to make his surfing dreams a reality and also painstakingly record the entire experience. Let's jump in.
I always wanted to learn how to surf. Surfing is the only sport with its own music. Baseball has the Wurlitzer organ and football has the marching band, but surf music actually describes the thing itself. I love surf music, and for a long time, I thought I could learn to surf just by listening to the music alone. Like the Mermen, my favorite group, a bass, a drummer, a lead guitar. They became my teachers, and I learned a great deal from them. I walked around, ate, slept, and worked with Jim Thomas's liquid reverb stuck in my head like a cosmic mantra. But there came a point this last summer when I realized my study could go no farther, and in order to progress, I'd actually have to get wet. So I went online and found a surf school on the web. It was in the surf mecca of the world, the north shore of Oahu, and the advertisement said that the students camped out on the beach, right next to the ocean. It seemed perfect, so I signed up. No questions asked. But when I got there to the campground on the northern tip of the island, I realized the school was not what I expected. I was the only student, when there wasn't even a surfboard for me to use. My instructor, a full-blooded Hawaiian named Miles Apuakehau, was there putting up a big tent, and he was really pissed off, driving wooden stakes into the sand with a sledgehammer like he was going to send them to the center of the earth. Miles was an experienced surfer and the vice president of the North Shore Surf Club, the Hui, but this was his first day working as an instructor, and he was thinking about quitting right then and there. He said the woman who ran the school, his boss, knew nothing about surfing or running a business. All she knew how to do was make a website. And she was really cheap. She told him not to eat any of the good food, the expensive food, as that was just for me. He said, "She wants me to eat Spam. I don't need this shit. Let her teach you how to surf." Another thing I didn't expect was that I had a hard time understanding Miles when he spoke. I didn't know that Hawaiians, or at least some Hawaiians, speak with a thick accent, dropping off parts of words, using other words I'd never heard.
"I'm the guy in the water. I can stand on the beach, I can tell you some stuff. That's why he came down here. You out there, you know, we ain't able to smile at nobody. I mean, like, who's this guy? Unless you get a nice, you know, rolling wave that only break the top third of the wave, and I think just keep on going. That's Kahana Bay kind, but you rarely find places like that."
Did you get that? Neither did I, at least in the beginning. Miles was a trip. Dark skin, huge shoulders, intense fiery eyes like Miles Davis. Not at all the image of the happy Hawaiian I had fixed in my mind. He was pissed off at a lot more than his boss.
"Yeah, I cannot trust a white guy as far as I can spit, actually. Yeah. Remember, it's changed with the time. Or they just give you the cold shoulder. But if they like be like that, that's his loss."
I thought about getting upset, but then I realized I was in Hawaii, and the air smelled like flowers, and the ocean was 100 feet away, and Miles was putting up this large tent, like a Bedouin shelter, made from sheets of heavy plastic and poles of ironwood he'd cut down, tied with knots I'd never seen before, using golf balls to hold the plastic so it wouldn't rip out in the wind, and the tent would be a good home. Plus, he had this very strange bicycle leaning against a tree. The frame was from a kid's BMX bicycle, but the forks were from a 10-speed, and it had a big machete hanging down from the seat to the pedals, a toolkit on the back rack that included channel locks, socket wrenches, and a drawing compass. Looking at that bike and the tent, I knew that while Miles may have some issues, he was still the real thing, a surfer, not a bum, but somebody who'd figured out how to live close to the land, close to the things that made him truly happy, and I felt lucky to have him as my instructor. Besides Miles, there was his girlfriend, Daylin Vickery, whose official job was to take care of the camp, but really she was more like my interpreter, not for Miles, but to explain Hawaiian culture to me.
"To be Hawaiian is a state of mind. Anybody can be Hawaiian at heart. You know? Hawaiians, they love to love. They like simple. They like smooth. They like to rise with the tide, go with the flow. You can see a Hawaiian from far away by the way they walk. Look at Miles, how he walks. His back is straight. He walks straight. He look at you straight in the eye. He doesn't turn away when you look at him. I don't turn away when we speak to you. When you speak to us, we look you straight in the face. So we can see what kind of person you are. Yeah, I think people are people all over the world. But I think Hawaiians are desperately trying to hold on with what little we have left of our Hawaiian-ness. We're so conditioned to live the white man way because it was rammed down our throats. They mostly take and we mostly give. And I think that's where the animosity and that's where the generations of anger, deep down anger, come from. But luckily for us, we invented surfing. And that's awesome.
Although the woman who ran the school didn't have a surfboard for me to use, she did give me a windsurfing board, which was kind of like a surfboard, except that it had a sandpaper surface on top that Miles said was going to give me a rash. I didn't care. I just wanted to get in the water. So the first day, we went down to the beach and sat there looking out at the waves. I thought Miles was going to give me a long, sort of philosophical lecture on how to do it, but all he said was, "Watch out for the Portuguese men of war, and don't turn your back on the ocean." That was it. I tried to follow him as he paddled out, but I got stung by a man of war about 20 feet from the beach. And while I was flailing around trying to get it off my leg, a wave broke on top of me and sent me to the floor, where my board flew up in the air and then came back down on my head. The first thing I noticed once I got going was that paddling was hard. The windsurfing board was heavy and awkward, and the wind was blowing me back to the beach, and the current was taking me down the shoreline, and my arms felt like toothpicks in the water. Plus, it was hard to hold my head up off the board. I was using muscles I didn't really have. And then, I'd say within the first half hour, that 80 grit on top of the board tore the skin off my chest. It hurt. Salt water does not feel good on abrasions. I spent about 2 hours in the water, and all I did was flail around and get thrashed by the waves, my arms and legs pulled from their sockets. Water ran down my throat like I had my mouth around a fire hose. Pretty pathetic. I crawled up on the beach and lay there like a sick puppy. The next day, I refused to go back out on the windsurfing board. It was too cruel. My chest was like raw hamburger. So we hitchhiked into town, and Miles got his longboard out of a friend's garage. It was beautiful. It must have been worth about $1,000. I was worried I was going to mess it up and said I'd rather just rent a cheap board somewhere. But Miles insisted, saying it was the perfect board for me because it was easy to paddle and stand up on. And he was right. It made all the difference in the world. I was able to follow Miles and watch what he was doing, and that was all it took, just watching what he did. No need for talking, just do it. Get out there in the right place, sit up on the board looking out at the waves coming in, wait until you see a big one coming, then turn the board around and lie down so your hands are on the sides, about right in the middle. Keep looking back at the wave. It either breaks before it gets to you, smashing on top of you, and all of a sudden you're in a blender set on pulverize, or it doesn't break at all and just passes you by, or it comes up like a living being, like it should have a name, and you know it's there for you. So you paddle hard, and the thing picks you up and throws you forward. The board is shaking. You're strapped onto a rocket and just want to hold on, but you've got to stand up, quickly. Push up and jump to the center of the board. Feet spread out, knees bent, and ride the thing. Look back, try to stay on the edge of the whitewash. I made a lot of mistakes, but I did do it right a number of times. Stood up and got some good rides. And man, I'm telling you, it felt good. To be honest, the waves where we were at were not that big. Maybe 5 feet at the highest, measured from the front, but just right for learning. And the water was amazing. Not cold at all, luminescent, iridescent blue and green like it was lit from below. It was clean. Do the drill. That's the only word I can think of. Clean like Jim Thomas's guitar. Clean like fresh powder snow. Clean like a cold morning in the desert. Every cell in my body was happy. After a couple days surfing there at the beach where we were camped, I asked Miles if we could go find some bigger waves. But he said there weren't really any bigger waves right then, that it was the wrong season, no storms coming in, and anyway, it was better for me to learn on this beach, where there weren't any rocks or coral or dangerous wave actions.
But it's better that you learn on something like this, because they guys that begin to learn off of surfing. They go out, and they come surfing, resurfing, and these guys, they get slammed, I mean, you know. These guys catch a wave, and they go straight down, hit the bottom of the reef. You know, he's the top of the reef under the water. Pick up some strawberries on the side. Not to mention, you know, the bald might whack them. They freaking gasping for air. Maybe get up and a local guy come with a pound him because he dropped in and he f***ed up the wave. Look how much stuff went happen to the guy. And he's just trying to learn. Okay, so jump out of the water and go home, style a surf bond that. So you're going to learn. No, go where you think you can. Go where you know you can. Because accidents happen. Attitude getting hurt. Don't worry about it. If you're going to get hurt, you're going to get hurt. Nothing you can do about it. It's like destiny.
One day we went fishing with Miles' throw net. He didn't catch anything, but I got to spend the whole day staring into the water, looking for fish, which in my book is what it's all about anyway. The light in Hawaii is like a drug, the kind of thing you can feel going into your body and changing your chemistry, the kind of thing that makes you sick when you leave. All in all, I had a great time. I wouldn't really recommend the surfing school. I won't even mention it by name, but I would recommend Miles as a teacher. He doesn't talk much about surfing, but you can learn a lot by watching him. One other thing I learned, Hawaiians don't listen to surf music. I asked Daylin if she'd ever heard of the Mermen, and she said, "The who?" She said on Hawaii they listen to Hawaiian music, like Brother Is. Israel Kamaka Wiwa'ole, a 500-pound man who played the ukulele. He died young in 1997 due to complications of his enormous size. All Hawaiians truly love the man because of his big heart. They still cry when they hear his music. It's not at all like surf music, not at all what I expected, but some trips are like that. For the Savvy Traveler, this is Scott Carrier.
That piece was produced by Scott Carrier for the public radio show The Savvy Traveler. Scott launched his own podcast earlier this year, and it's been on steady rotation in my headphones ever since. It's called Home of the Brave, and you can hear more at homebrave.com. So, two words, homebrave.com. I'll also have a link up on KALW.org under The Spot. That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at KALW.org. Look at the homepage for the little blue letters that spell out The Spot. And tell me what you want to hear on The Spot. If you have a suggestion for a podcast we should feature, please drop me a line at thespot@kalw.org. Tune in next Thursday, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on KALW San Francisco.